The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Dairy Boss, How Gary Cartwright Helped Revive North Carolina State University's Dairy Program. And the cover story actually begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, How Ice Cream Saved the Herd, written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. On a cold and rainy weekend at the 1977 NC State Fair in Raleigh, fairgoers walking past one stand would ask the student attending it, Gary Cartwright, the same question. Is this ice cream from NC State? It was not. The NC State Food Science Club had purchased the ice cream through private creameries. People weren't thrilled. They'd just say, oh, and either walk away or just get a cup of coffee, Cartwright says. Selling ice cream at the fair earned the program just $1,500 that year. But Cartwright, an undergraduate, convinced the heads of his department to start making NC State ice cream, provided he could get the major North Carolina creameries on board. And so the Wolfpack's own ice cream was born, and the next year, the program raised $15,000 at the fair. NC State ice cream, now known as Howling Cow, would rise as the premier economic driver of the university's struggling dairy program, and the proceeds it generated would help save its dairy farm. Without it, a university proud of its agrarian roots and whose rivals once mocked it as Cow College might not even have cows. But in a time of narrowing margins for many North Carolina dairy farms, the remarkable turnaround has offered a blueprint for success. NC State's cows produce both milk and ice cream, the value-added product that makes the operation more efficient and profitable. The importance of this to the greater dairy industry is you either increase the amount of milk you produce on a farm or you produce a value-added product, a local product, says Carl Hollifield, the interim director of the university's Dairy Enterprise System. In 2019, the creamery brought in $2.2 million, a drop in the bucket for a school with a total budget of north of $1.6 billion, but enough to cover its costs. And those dollars will increase. Howling Cow now has a licensing deal with Harris Teeter, and NC State's success with its dairy operation stands as an example of how universities and industries can collaborate to both train future employees and use the intellectual heft of the universities to help businesses thrive. We kind of accidentally backed into exactly where the dairy industry wants to be with value added, Cartwright says. The economics pushed us there, and that's exactly the forces that are working on dairy farmers now, pushing them this direction. Yankee history. On the side of Lake Wheeler Road, just south of Raleigh, where neighborhoods and shopping centers give way to pastures and ponds, a herd of about 300 cows belonging to NC State grazes. The farm is an eclectic mix of dilapidated wooden barns and modern facilities with shiny new hardware, all framed by the Raleigh skyline rising beyond the gentle slopes of grassland. Some 60% of the cows are black and white spotted Holsteins, prized for the high volume of milk they produce. The others are smaller brown Jerseys, who produce less milk but higher butterfat content, terrific for cream. That Jersey herd is the result of a surprise donation from William Rand Keenan Jr., a wealthy industrialist and UNC Chapel Hill graduate, who bequeathed the herd to the University of North Carolina system. After his death in 1965, lawyers for his estates called UNC system president Bill Friday to inform him that much of the Keenan's estate was being donated to the university system, including a herd of Jersey cows. But the cows were grazing in Lockport, New York, and Friday was perplexed at what to do with the cows and how to transport them until being told the herd came with a $2 million stipend. They landed off Lake Wheeler Road. Business of cows. NC State has produced dairy products for more than a century. The first time milk was pasteurized in North Carolina happened in the basement of the school's Patterson Hall in 1918. In the 1940s, NC State opened a dairy production facility and began distributing milk to campus and state facilities, including hospitals and prisons. But due to the Umstead Act, a 1939 state law prohibiting state government agencies from competing with the private sector, the plant's operations never sold products directly to consumers. Cartwright returned to NC State in the late 1990s after working for a number of private companies across the country, running the plant operations with a private sector mindset. Cartwright helped rebrand the ice cream as Howling Cow, a nod to NC State's Wolfpack mascot, and made the entire production plant, with its supporting educational and research components, self-supporting. In 2005, Cartwright also helped get an exception written into the law allowing sales at university-owned facilities, so long as the profits are used to support the Department of Food Science and the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. At the time, the production plant was separate from the university's farm and much of its agricultural programs. But as the recession deepened in 2009, the production plant was called to take over the farm as well. Budgets were being reduced for the university, and the dairy farm was at risk of being closed, Cartwright says. Dean Johnny Wynn knew the critical nature of the farm, and he said, "The students of NC State expect Howling Cow to have NC State milk in it. Figure something out." Making a business. The result was the Dairy Enterprise System, a new organization headed by Cartwright and Hollyfield, then a business officer who started at the university as an accounting clerk. "They put people in charge who had no idea what was going on at a dairy farm. We're processing people," Hollyfield says. "So we immediately brought in faculty, dairy husbandry, animal nutritionists, to get a third party in here to take a look at how everything is done." Marty Day, a specialized dairy agent with NC State's Cooperative Extension Program, says, "Before Gary and Carl got involved in the production end of it, the dairy was really, really lacking." The pair lacked agrarian expertise, but they excelled in budgets and efficiency, stripping away administrative overhead and allowing the farm's experts to operate to the best of their knowledge. And Hollyfield says they used the success of Howling Cow to adjust the reimbursement rates for the milk produced on the farm, essentially telling the farm leaders to spend what they needed to be successful and then billing the processing plant for the farm's operating budget divided by gallons of milk. To recoup the increased cost of milk, the plant leveraged its oldest contracts with the prison system, which agrees to pay a fixed annual rate for 1% milk. The cows on NC State's farms were producing closer to 5% milk, meaning the excess could be skimmed off to produce products such as Howling Cow. At the same time, the prison system benefited from fixed-year pricing for their supply, something private industry couldn't provide because of the fluctuating prices of raw milk. "A standard dairy plant is having to go out on the commodity market, and they're having to buy milk," Hollyfield says. "Well, I own the farm, and with the exception of the feed, I have a pretty basic baseline cost to run a farm. The strategy is establishing a baseline to break even on the main production and then finding sources of additional sources of revenue, branching off as value added." In 2010, the operation brought in about $1.5 million in revenue. In 2019, it brought in $2.2 million, a 38% increase. During the same period, total milk volume production actually dropped from 419,100 gallons to nearly 394,100 gallons, a 6% decrease. The strategy is also one of the few NC State had available because the alternative, simply producing more milk with more cows, was complicated by Umstead Act exemption, an allowance made with the blessing of the state's private dairy producers. The university cannot brazenly work to produce more milk or push more ice cream to the general public, lest it risk severing its relationship with the private sectors and losing its exemption. But many local farms also cannot afford to just increase their scale, which is why Hollyfield and many in the private industry believe value added is the wiser strategy. 16 miles south of Greensboro, for example, the Bowman family has run a dairy farm for seven generations, but the massive changes in how milk is produced have had an impact. Current plant manager Paige Garland says surviving as a family farm today means operating in completely new ways. "Our dairy was suffering, and we decided, let's do something before we have to do something," she says. The Bowman Farm, now known as Homeland Creamery, is far from the days of just producing raw milk for wholesale. Garland says the family built its own production plant and began focusing on producing its own milk and ice cream, much like NC State. She says to survive, the family realized it couldn't try to compete with wholesalers and had to produce consumer goods more coveted for the locally sourced brand they represent. There were over 2,000 dairy farms in North Carolina in the 50s, and today there are less than 200, Garland says. When there are mega dairies such as Walmart, who has their dairy out in the western part of the country, and when you go to the grocery store and see a gallon of milk for a dollar, I can't even produce raw milk from a cow on my own farm for that. Businesses that can't compete. At NC State, the value in value added doesn't mean just profits. In fact, Holyfield says that every dollar beyond their operating costs goes back into educational programming and research support because, at its heart, it remains a university operation. Housed in both the production facility and the farm are a litany of research efforts by faculty and educational programs for students, including the kinds of hands-on experience that industry seeks. Mike Veach, the dairy farm manager, says the idea is to operate it at the same speed and practice as an industrial farm. Research that comes off a farm that is already high-end production is powerful research. If you show you can increase production off an already high-performing farm, Cartwright says. Each cow has radio frequency identification collars, which corresponds to milking stations in the new facility. When each cow is milked, a small sample is collected, registering the milk with the data collected by the collar, such as the amount of steps each cow has taken. Researchers can keep appraise of each cow's nutritional and health needs, placing them in different feed categories or making other necessary adjustments. And since taking over operation of the farm, the program has poured money into upgrading the facilities and infrastructure, with more renovations and construction planned. Not a bit of tax dollars, not a penny, to build all these buildings, Cartwright says. Everything is donations or capital funds. We don't even expect state funding anymore. The program has signed a deal with Harris Teeter that launched last year, allowing the grocer to sell Howling Cow ice cream under the program's branding. The deal has already earned the agricultural program's $115,000 in total royalty receipts, representing 3 quarters ended in September, where the grocer was slowly expanding beyond just local stores. Now, the brand is selling at more than 150 of the roughly 250 locations. The system is also looking to educate students in public and grade schools, another potential untapped source of opportunity. A museum is the flagship of that effort, as well as a new creamery store located just off the side of Lake Wheeler. Creamery supervisor Courtney London imagines a Disneyland for cows once completed and chuckles at how some young visitors thought milk came from the grocery store, not from cows. We really want to get the kids that have never seen a farm, the children that don't understand that cows are real and out there moseying around, she says. Close to the product. Gary Cartwright is no farmer, but he has had a lasting impact on those who are. Dressed in a leather jacket and slacks, Cartwright seems out of place walking amongst mooing cows and bustling farmhands. In the crisp morning air, he spends more time discussing logistics and business models than animal husbandry and farm work. Just days before his retirement in December, Cartwright milked a cow for the first time. "I'm probably the only guy to ever milk cows in black leather," he says. But the image of a leather-clad engineer milking cows personifies the increasingly blurred line between milk producers and the processing plants they once existed to supply. Garland, the family farmer, says the value-added approach perfected at NC State is a necessity, the only way smaller farms are going to survive. "People want to get back to knowing where their food comes from. They want fresh. They want local," she says. "We were working toward a commercialized food source, and now we're trying to go back the other way." And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Wilmington seafood concept to keep growing in Triangle. Given the proximity to the North Carolina coast, it's a surprise the Triangle doesn't have more seafood restaurants. There's the 42nd Street Oyster Bar and a smattering of others, but given the fact that you can leave Raleigh and have your feet in the sand in 2 hours, the lack of seafood overall seems odd. Now a pair of entrepreneurs is trying to change that. In Wilmington, Evans Trawick opened the Cape Fear Seafood Company in 2008 and then added two more restaurants in that market. Two of his former employees, Eddie Elliott and Matt Wibble, bought the franchise rights for this area and opened a franchise last June on Raleigh's Spring Forest Road. Overall, our expectations have been exceeded, Elliott says, but we knew it was a good product and people liked it in Wilmington. And they've signed on for two more franchises in the Triangle. Their next target, fast-growing Cary. After that, they'll fish around for another location in the market. During the driving the decision to open a restaurant in Raleigh, he says, was obviously the proximity to Wilmington, the amount of Raleigh people who had been to the restaurants on vacation. The ties between Raleigh and Wilmington are very close, and word can get out. We really rely on word of mouth. Big projects coming across Raleigh. A new commercial real estate summary from Colliers gives a glimpse of the remarkable pace of growth across the Triangle. The Colliers report includes a list of proposed projects for the area. In Raleigh alone, there are 14 projects scheduled with a total of nearly 6.6 million square feet. To put that in perspective, Crabtree Valley Mall is 1.3 million square feet. Raleigh's Warehouse District sees big jump in restaurants. Raleigh's Warehouse District is becoming one of the city's hottest places to be when it comes to dining out or grabbing a drink. In fact, the area had the biggest gain among downtown Raleigh hotspots when it came to monies generated from the food and beverage tax, according to data collected by the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. Bill King, the downtown group's president and CEO, notes that the area has been bolstered by a wave of new options to eat and drink, including Morgan Street Food Hall, Weaver Street Grocery Store, Table Raleigh, Oku Sushi, the Barcelona Wine Bar, Junction West, and Heirloom Brew Shop. Panera Bread drops plans to add store in Knightdale. Panera Bread isn't headed to Knightdale after all. The St. Louis-based restaurant chain has locations peppered across the Triangle, with many clustered across western Wake County. Panera Bread had planned to build a 4,200-square-foot restaurant at the intersection of Knightdale and Parkstone Town Boulevards, but now those plans are canceled. Jonas Silver, the public information officer for the town of Knightdale, says the town council approved the project and had been working with Panera on the construction drawings. Then, unfortunately, we were informed that Panera would no longer be pursuing the site. Silver says no new plans have been submitted for the site. The property is owned by the Wide Waters Group out of DeWitt, New York. Local clothing designer has high-end hopes. The Triangle is a long way from the fashion capitals of New York, Paris, and Milan, but a local designer is looking to make a dent in those worlds. Stephen Allen has launched Grey Chenier, taking his inspiration from leading British designer Lee Alexander McQueen and Italian fashion icon Gianni Versace. The look, with hand-sewn products featuring leather and denim, launches in February, and Allen hopes to break into New York Fashion Week in September. "I've always loved fashion," Allen says. "I'm obsessed with couture, high-end clothing, so this all came very naturally to me." The company now has 5 employees and produces the clothes in Raleigh. And finally, Italian sauce company based in Raleigh, closing. Nellino's Sauce Company is closing down, according to a Facebook post. Founder Neil McTighe wrote that many factors go into this difficult decision, but that he felt the time was right to close the company after 9 years. He spent 10 months in Italy as a college student and was inspired by the experience. The company was originally named Nello's, and as of 2012, the sauce was in 1,300 stores. And now we turn to Lauren Onosorge's page on tech, startups, and transportation. The first headline, end of the line for energy drink. Eric Masters, CEO of Matty Energy, says, "We gave it a good shot." Speaking after the Durham-based company disclosed it is shutting down, he says it came down to money. While the all-natural energy drink startup made a lot of progress in 2019 in terms of winning shelf space, it came up against heavy competition, Master says. "It's a very difficult and crowded category," he notes. "There are a lot of new entrants and a lot of deep-pocketed competitors." To keep up, Matty, which had already raised $15 million during its lifetime, would need to raise more. And after weeks of hustle, it became clear that it wasn't happening. "We have been pushing down a variety of potential funding paths," Master says. "Unfortunately, none of them have materialized." The firm has stopped production at its facility in Clayton. There are remote possibilities for salvation. A buyer could step up, for example, but as time goes by, that appears unlikely. With the amount and with the steps we're taking, there are disruptions to the business, he says, but certainly there's always the potential, and we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Maddie is selling its remaining cans at a discount through its website. Tatiana Bergeson created the company in 2012 when she was a student at Duke University. She left the company in 2018. Maddie had a slew of local backing from Duke Angel Network to Hatteras Venture Partners to Idea Fund Partners and Harbright Ventures. Master says all have been supportive of the firm's decision to shutter. Lister Delgado, a managing partner at Idea Fund Partners, says he's still a fan of Maddie. One thing I've learned from this experience is that it takes a lot of money to make a beverage company successful, he says. Another is that mistakes are costly in this industry, and you are not afforded many. Chris Heavely, vice president of innovation at Techstar, says it's a cautionary tale for entrepreneurs. This is a reminder that this stuff is hard, and the challenge never goes away, he says. Early success is not a signal of later success. Spiffy, to expand from washing cars to tires. Research Triangle Park-based car care startup Spiffy is entering the tire business. The company, which started out washing cars on demand before expanding into other services, such as oil changes, announced that it now has mobile vans that can come to a customer's office and install new tires. Spiffy is already servicing about 1,000 vehicles per day, and by its own estimates, between 5% and 10% of those vehicles have tires with low treads. It's been on our radar for about a year to figure it all out, CEO Scott Wingo says. One of the challenges is it requires a specialized type of truck. The truck must be equipped with equipment that can remove, install, and test new tires. Spiffy next had to tackle the tire supply chain. With the launch of the new service, Spiffy will feature brands such as Michelin, Continental, and BF Goodrich. Spiffy isn't trying to replace roadside assistance providers such as AAA, Wingo says. The typical use case is your tread is low, he says. You want the convenience of having it fixed without going to a tire shop. Records detail competition for aviation jobs in Kinston. After months of negotiations, a long-sought-after startup known by the code name Project Ostrich announced plans to bring nearly 500 jobs to North Carolina. The startup subsidiary of Aircraft Solutions said in December it would create 475 jobs and invest nearly $100 million in a new aircraft recycling operation at Kinston's Global Transpark. Public records show incentives mattered. As the company considered five other locations, the expected offer for incentives for the competitors was Dothan, Alabama, between $13 million and $15 million, Panama, Florida, between $6 and $7 million, Peoria, Illinois, between $14 and $15 million, Longview, Texas, between $19 and $21 million, and Cheyenne, Wyoming, between $31 and $33 million. Including the state's Job Development Investment Grant, worth up to $4.8 million, it became clear that additional incentives would be needed to keep the project's interest in North Carolina. Altogether, the state would pony up more than $25.6 million in incentives. Boston remains a popular spot for RDU travelers. For Raleigh-Durham International Airport flyers, Boston remains a hot ticket. Once again, Boston tops the most popular destinations list at RDU, with more than 824 passengers flying between RDU and Boston each day. And the route could get even more competitive, as earlier this month, American Airlines announced the pending debut of its own nonstop flight to Boston. When that flight takes off, five carriers, American, Delta, Frontier, JetBlue, and Spirit, will serve the route, making it easily the airport's most competitive. But it's not alone. Here are the top 10 destinations out of Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Boston, with 824 per day. Orlando, 678 passengers per day. New York, 625. Newark, 594. Chicago, 583. Atlanta, 533. Denver, 513. Los Angeles, 400 passengers per day. Fort Lauderdale, 396. And San Francisco, 387 passengers per day. And finally, in a section called He Said It, that's 15 years ahead of schedule on the forecast. Fortunately, we have plans to accommodate that level of growth. We just need to accelerate them. And that's from Bill Sandifer, Chief Operating Officer of the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority, at a specially called meeting January 27. He predicted that by the end of 2020, the airport could reach passenger levels not expected until 2036. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Caleb Harshberger. The first headline, Atlantic Avenue Ironworks Project Gets Underway. Grub Ventures is ready to start work on its latest adaptive reuse project in Raleigh, and it's partnering with a national firm on the development. Grub is linking up with Atlanta-based Jamestown for the Ironworks Project, which will transform former steel warehouses off Atlantic Avenue into a mixed-use destination with 500,000 square feet of office space, retail, and hundreds of residential units. Plans for the Ironworks call for a multi-phase development to convert a property formerly owned by Pete and Steele into 500,000 square feet of creative office space, more than 90,000 square feet of retail, and 220 residential units. The site is at the corner of East Whitaker Mill Road and Atlantic Avenue, across from Dock 1053, another of Grubb's adaptive use reuse projects. Jamestown is a real estate investment and management firm with projects around the country. It is known for its role in popular adaptive reuse projects such as Chelsea Market in New York and Ponce City Market in Atlanta. Work on the first phase of Ironworks is expected to begin this year with the construction of a 7-story multifamily building and the renovation of the decades-old warehouses, which will ultimately house creative office and retail space. The first phase of the project is valued at $150 million, according to Grub Ventures. We are thrilled to be partnering with Jamestown to pioneer the new Ironworks District in Raleigh, says Gordon Grubb, president of Grubb Ventures. Our partnership with Jamestown, a national leader in adaptive reuse projects, is going to allow us to set a standard for creative class space in Raleigh, unseen so far, and create an iconic destination for residents and visitors alike. Grubb Ventures bought the site, which includes 3 warehouses, from the Peden family for $10 million in early 2017, betting it could duplicate the success of Dock 1053, a former grocery warehouse across Atlantic Avenue that Grubb reimagined as a site for creative office space and restaurants. Dock 1053 also houses Linwood Brewing Concern, among others. Developer picked for $140 million project in RTP. Plans for a 100-acre development in Research Triangle Park took a big leap forward January 28 with the launch of a new partnership set to build up to 1 million square feet of new office space in what will be the first high-rise buildings in RTP. The Research Triangle Foundation announced its partnership with Dallas-based KDC to develop Hub RTP, a 43-acre multi-use urban district in the park with buildings up to 300 feet tall. This is the long-anticipated opportunity to retool RTP. With the support of Durham County, the companies in RTP and private partners, including KDC, we can do this in 2020, says Scott Levitan, president and CEO of RTF. Today's companies and workforce are looking for an integrated live, work, and play environment. We are creating that kind of energy in the heart of RTP. Plans for the project call for up to 1 million square feet of office space, at least one hotel with up to 375 rooms, 850 residential units, and 150,000 square feet of retail space. The project is transformative for Research Triangle Park and will create the integrated mixed-use environment desired by today's workforce, says Larry Wilson, division president for KDC. He says the total cost of the project is expected to be around $140 million, and construction is expected to begin in 2021. And in a section called By the Numbers, the Triangle office market rounded out 2019 with a strong quarter and another banner year as demand continues to be strong for office space across the region. The average Class A asking rental rate broke the $30 barrier for the first time in fourth quarter 2019, rising 5% year over year, according to a recent report by Avis & Young. The increase follows a 7.5% jump in 2018. Triangle office sales in 2019 once again exceeded $1 billion for the fourth time in the last 5 years. Singapore Investment Group buys AC Hotel at North Hills. A real estate investor from Singapore has acquired a hotel in North Hills that has been open for less than 3 years. ARA U.S. Hospitality Trust bought the AC Hotel for $32.2 million this month, records show. The hotel is situated on 0.7 acres at 101 Park at North Hill Street in Raleigh. It's next to the Bank of America Tower and the Dartmouth North Hills Apartments at the intersection of Six Forks and Dartmouth Roads. Developed as a joint venture between Raleigh-based Concord Hospitality and Kane Realty Corporation, the AC Hotel is a Marriott International branded 135-room hotel with European-style aesthetics. The hotel opening in the spring of 2017. And among its amenities is a seventh-floor rooftop bar and lounge called Level 7. When it opened, it was one of the largest rooftop entertainment venues in Raleigh. ARA U.S. Hospitality Trust portfolio currently consists of more than 40 hotels, totaling more than 5,000 rooms across 22 states in the U.S., according to its website. The purchase comes as developers and investors around the country continue to eye the Triangle for hotel potential. And finally, Cameron Village condos sold after a three-year battle. After more than 3 years, a couple of suitors, and what a local broker describes as one of the most challenging real estate transactions, a Cameron Village condominium community has a new owner. Camden Property Trust of Houston has acquired the Bellwood condominiums with plans to redevelop the property into a new multifamily community. Brokers spent years working with dozens of condo owners before the deal closed this month. The firm paid around $17.5 million for the property, according to a tally of the 55 deeds. We fully intend to present a development plan for the property soon, but have no further information to offer at this time, says Will Smith, Vice President of Real Estate Investments for Camden Property Trust. We really like the Raleigh market, and this development parcel, coming on the heels of last month's purchase of Camden Carolinian, gives us further opportunity in the market. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Seth Thomas Gulledge's page on healthcare and education. Here's who stands to gain from PPD's IPO. In the upcoming $1.44 billion initial public offering of Wilmington-based pharmaceutical product development, several executives could stand to benefit from its $25.50 price per share. PPD first announced its intention to go public again in November and filed preliminary paperwork for its offering earlier this year. The company, with around 2,000 employees in the Triangle, plans to trade on the NASDAQ under the ticker symbol PPD. The company is primarily owned by private equity firm Hellman & Friedman, which controls 56.7% of PPD's outstanding stock, according to its most recent filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. With more than 158.4 million shares, the investment firm's share of stock would be worth more than $4.03 billion. Behind H&F is Carlyle Investors, which owns 66.4 million shares, or 23.8% of the company. At $25.50 per share, its portfolio would be worth $1.69 billion. Here's how much other firms could collect. Blue Spectrum Investor, 25.5 million shares worth $652.4 million. GIC Investor, 25.5 million shares worth $652.4 million. Combined, PPD's executives and directors own just 1.9% of the entire company, or 5.48 million shares. The most are owned by Chairman and CEO David Simmons, who owns just over 3 million shares. His haul at $25.50 per share would be $77.4 million. The company priced its offering at $25.50 per share with a maximum estimated share price of $27 per share. It plans to offer 60 million shares altogether and to use its new proceeds to pay off some high-interest rate holdco notes totaling $550 million and $900 million. The notes have an interest rate of 7.6 or 8.3%. PPD was founded in the mid-1980s and first went public in 1996. In late 2011, it was acquired by a pair of private equity firms for $3.9 billion. PPD reported $3.7 billion in revenue in 2018 and more than $2.9 billion in the 9 months ending September 30, 2019. Why a Durham NGO is expanding into the UK? A Durham-based international non-government organization, or NGO, is opening offices in the United Kingdom, something the organization says is emblematic of its commitment to both the UK and Europe. FHI 360 has opened an office in London, joining its offices in Durham, Washington, D.C., Thailand, and South Africa. The company focuses on working with governments as well as the private sector to provide healthcare, education, and, quote, opportunities for meaningful economic participation, unquote. We are thrilled to be in the United Kingdom and look forward to expanding our partnership with the Department for International Development, DFID, and the other committed organizations in the region, CEO Patrick Fine says. He says DFID and UK civil society actors have been on the forefront of responsible human development policies. I hope we can become even more deeply woven into the fabric of the development community, Fine says. I am particularly excited about our efforts focused on developing innovative financial solutions with new regional partners to meet increasingly sophisticated global development challenges. UNC study: jargon limits healthcare transparency. Beyond simply being discontent about the high cost of healthcare in the nation, consumers remain in the dark over what that cost may be, even for a standard treatment for prostate cancer, according to a study out of UNC Chapel Hill. At UNC's North Carolina Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, Dr. Trevor Royce and a team of other researchers looked into whether recent federal policies have increased transparency for patients. Specifically, they looked to see if a federal rule that requires hospitals to publicly list standard charges for services and procedures actually improves the situation. Looking at 63 different National Cancer Institute designated cancer centers across the nation for pricing information regarding simple intensity modulated radiation therapy, or IMRT, for prostate cancer, researchers found that the information was largely unhelpful, missing, or even unintelligible. Essentially, our experience showed that a lot of these systems were just taking the internal documents and posting it online and not necessarily editing it for public consumption, Roy says. It's filled with technical jargon and can be hard to find exactly what you're looking for. Liquidia looking for key FDA approval. Morrisville-based Liquidia Technologies has reached the end of its drug development pathway and has submitted its lead candidate for potential approval by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Liquidia has announced its submission of its new drug application, NDA, for LIQ861, its inhaled dry powder treatment for patients with pulmonary artery hypertension, or PAH. The application is supported by three successive clinical studies the company has conducted over recent years. The company held a pre-NDA meeting with the FDA in the third quarter 2019. The company plans to commence with commercialization of the drug if it earns FDA approval. The submission of the NDA for LIQ861 in the U.S. is a significant milestone for our company and our goal to address an important unmet need in the delivery of inhaled therapy for PAH patients, CEO Neil Fowler said in a statement. Duke receives $5 million gift to its BAS Connection initiative. A major gift to Duke University is earmarked for research on complex societal problems. Duke has announced a $5 million gift from the Mary Alice Fortin Foundation in support of its BAS Connections program. The program is a university initiative bringing together faculty and students in research teams addressing an array of societal problems, including developing sustainable energy, fair elections, countering misinformation, and addressing public health challenges. The program was first established with the $50 million gift from Ann and Robert Bass in 2013, and it included a $25 million tranche for a challenge fund that would match subsequent donations, $1 for every $2. With the matching funds, the $5 million gift will bring the Bass Connections program to $7.5 million of unrestricted cash and finishes off the last of the challenge fund. And finally, in a closer look, $1.5 million. What the Fortin Foundation donated in previous support to the Bass Connections program in 2017 and 2018. Prior to that, the foundation donated $5 million to Duke Engage. And now we turn to the On Business page written by David Pertell. Average airfare at RDU continues steady drop. It continues to be a good time to take off from Raleigh-Durham International Airport. The average round-trip airfare at the airport dropped to $311 in the third quarter of 2019, according to the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. In fact, it's been dropping for years as competition among airlines continues to build. The national average was $345. In Charlotte, the average airfare came in at nearly $400. For Wilmington, it was $423, while at Piedmont Triad International Airport, the average was $407. Airline tickets across the country were at the lowest levels on record in the third quarter when adjusting for inflation. For RDU, airfares fell from an average of $340 in the second quarter of last year. But though ticket prices are falling, airlines are finding other ways to make travelers pay, such as adding more bag fees. For a one-way trip from RDU, the cheapest average ticket was to Trenton, New Jersey, at $77, while flights to Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle were the most expensive. RDU saw a record 14.2 million passengers in 2019, and officials don't see the numbers slowing down anytime soon. In the third quarter, the airport was the 32nd largest in the country in terms of passenger volume. North Carolina adds hospitality workers in 2019, loses in manufacturing. North Carolina's unemployment rate ended 2019 about the same as it started the year. The state's unemployment rate for December was 3.7%, matching the figure from December 2018. But the state's labor force did increase by 142,000 in 2019, according to the most recent data from the NC Department of Commerce. North Carolina's labor force totaled 5.13 million people by the end of the last decade, a nearly 3% increase year over year. The fastest growing employment sector for 2019 was leisure and hospitality services, with a growth rate of 5.9%. The sector added 30,000 workers in 2019 to reach a total of more than 538,000 workers. The second highest figure was for trade, transportation, and utilities, which added more than 18,000 workers. But the number of people employed in the state's manufacturing sector dropped by 1,900 to 472,000. It was the only employment sector to lose workers last year. For December, 191,451 people were identified as being unemployed in North Carolina, the seasonally adjusted data show. That figure was up 5,000 year over year. The total number of employed people was nearly $5 million in a state with a population approaching 10.5 million. The state's unemployment peaked at 4.2% during the summer of 2019. The national rate was never above 4% last year and ended 2019 at 3.5% in December. And here's a listing of the largest employment sectors in North Carolina in 2019. Trade, transportation, and utilities, 857,000. Government, 733,700. Professional and business services, 643,900. Education and health services, 625,900. And leisure and hospitality services, 538,100. And now we turn to A Better World inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene with the nonprofit news. Restaurant raises cash for Yao Fund. A Raleigh restaurant is raising funds for the K. Yao Cancer Fund as the restaurant celebrates a major renovation. The Melting Pot, a fondue restaurant at 3100 Wake Forest Road, is locally owned by brothers Mike and Matt Daly and is part of a franchise with 105 locations. From February 2 through 4, the Raleigh Melting Pot will offer a four-course menu where $10 from every order will go to the Yao Fund. Yao, the longtime women's basketball coach at NC State University, died of cancer in 2009. "We are so appreciative of the Melting Pot for their support of the K. Yao Cancer Fund," said Stephanie Glantz, CEO of the K. Yao Cancer Fund. "We are committed to awarding grants locally to make a significant impact in the lives of women and families across the state of North Carolina and are grateful for the support of local businesses that join us in serving our community. Cancer is a disease that impacts every family, but together we can make a difference and change lives," she says. The Melting Pot is celebrating 30 years in business with its renovation. Food bank adds hands. Want to get involved? The Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina is hosting its first Singles Night February 6th at locations in Raleigh and Durham. Beginning at 6 p.m., volunteers can help out for an hour and a half packing meals. After that, volunteers can hang out at Mordecai Beverage Company in Raleigh or Boxcar Bar and Arcade in Durham. The food bank suggests a $20 donation, which can fund up to 100 additional meals. Chapel to be renovated. The All Faiths Chapel of Dorothea Dix Hospital in Raleigh will undergo a $2 million renovation that will transform it into a multi-purpose facility with a welcome center. The chapel will house concerts, meetings, and educational events. The city of Raleigh bought the Dix property from the state in 2015. The chapel originally opened in 1955 but closed about 10 years ago. It is expected to reopen late this year or early next year. Methodist Home event ahead. The Methodist Home for Children in Raleigh is hosting a Winter's Tale February 1 at the Raleigh Convention Center. This year's speaker is columnist Celia Rivenbark, the noted humorist who lives in Wilmington. A Winter's Tale is the Methodist Home's annual fundraiser and includes auctions, dinner, and dancing as a way to celebrate the Methodist Home and raise funds to support children. And finally, the Greensboro Foundation joins a national effort. The Phillips Foundation, based in Greensboro, is one of the 11 organizations from across the U.S. to create the Community Investment Guarantee Pool. The pool, which guarantees with guarantee commitments totaling $33.1 million, is a new tool for community development finance. Its organizers expect it to spark more than $150 million in new community investments in small businesses, climate, and affordable housing. And now in general news in the Triangle Business Journal. Record number of data breaches reported in North Carolina in 2019. New numbers out of the North Carolina Department of Justice show a record number of data breaches in the state in 2019. In all, 1,210 breaches were reported to NCDOJ, the most since the reporting requirement began in 2005. The breaches impacted nearly 1.1 million North Carolinians, a 45% decrease from the 1.9 million impacted in 2018. In particular, hacking breaches reached an all-time high, making up more than half of all reports in 2019, and nearly half of the breaches involved emails. The biggest breaches, Jambov, doing business as ToonDo.com, the comic strip creation website, said an estimated 300,654 in the state were impacted. Quest Diagnostics, a third-party vendor, American Medical Collection Agency, notified the firm of potential unauthorized activity in March 2019. Quest estimated 148,723 North Carolinians were impacted. And Retrieval Masters Credit Bureau, doing business as American Medical Collection Agency, the vendor, identified by both Quest and LabCorp as the entity that put its customer data at risk, told the state it identified a possible security compromise of our web payments page impacting 90,055 people. And that was written by Lauren Onisorge. Caleb Harshberger writes this next article. Lennar plots 1,300 new homes in Apex. A major development in the works for Apex calls for a mixed-use destination with commercial space and the potential for more than 1,300 new homes. Miami-based Lennar Corporation has filed plans for Depot 499, a 200-acre mixed-use project with up to 650,000 square feet of commercial space, 850 apartments, and 650 townhomes and single-family homes, with a maximum of 50 single-family homes. The project is situated on the corner of South Salem Street and Apex Barbecue Road, just west of downtown Apex. The home-building giant filed a rezoning request with the town of Apex earlier this month to allow for the development. At an informational meeting in December, representatives for the developer said the plan would have a maximum of 1,350 homes. According to the developer's application, Depot 499 will be designed to feature a village commercial core surrounded by high-density residential living. Commercial uses would include office, retail stores, and restaurants, with office development permitted up to six stories. Apartment buildings will most likely be up to four stories, according to the application, and will be closest to the commercial core. From there, the development will transition to townhomes and single-family homes closer to Scotts Ridge Elementary School and the existing neighborhoods to the east of the project. Sidewalks and pedestrian greenways will be included to link the various uses and open spaces into a single walkable development. On December 19, the developers held a neighborhood meeting and took questions from more than 20 people on topics that included the project's traffic impact, its density, and the future tenants planned for the development. Company representatives told the group that the project would likely take about 10 years to complete and that speculative development is unlikely. According to the application, the development as presented would be built in 10 phases, the specifics of which would be decided during the master subdivision review and approval process. The property is currently made up of several parcels owned by a collection of families and individuals. Any costs or timelines on the project are unclear, and Lennar did not immediately return calls for comment. Founded in 1954, Lennar has built thousands of homes across the Triangle. In 2018, the most recent data available, Lennar was the largest residential developer in the Triangle. It completed 1,476 homes in 2018 for a total dollar volume of Triangle contracts closed at $561.7 million. And now we'll turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, buoyed by economy, TBJ hits new milestone again. When more than 75 new people move into our area every single day of the year, there's a ripple effect, and that reflects the success of our paper in the past few years. Triangle Business Journal was the fastest growing publication in 2019 among the 40 business journals spread across the country under the American City Business Journal's umbrella. Last year, our paid subscriptions rose more than 17%, setting yet another new record for us following a successful 2018 when subscriptions grew more than 13%. Your newspaper also ranked first in 2019 among total number of added subscriptions during the year. Overall, almost all of ACBJ's properties had big gains in subscriptions, with our digital products leading the way for growth across all sectors of our business. While our local economy is playing a significant role in pushing TBJ's success to new levels, this is a good time for me to thank our dedicated staff of reporters, editors, designers, and photographers for their hard work during the year. When you receive our morning edition and our afternoon edition each weekday and then sit back and read our Friday print edition, I am sure most of you have noticed some of the additions we have incorporated into our coverage to bolster engagement with you. We have added new features in our online coverage, including TBJ Plus, a collection of news items of interest to the Raleigh-Durham business community, and additional intelligence on our weekly list research with a feature called List Insights, headed by Cameron Snipes, our associate editor, that details the performance of our list toppers across a variety of industries. We have increased our emphasis on retail and restaurant coverage by design editor Dathan Kazak because you wanted us to report on the opportunities, challenges, openings, and closings of shops and stores in your neighborhoods. Reporters Lauren Arnasorge and Seth Thomas Gulledge broke some major stories in the past year, and managing editor Dane Huffman orchestrated the reporting, research, editing, and presentation of some complicated, in-depth pieces, from disaster coverage of hurricanes to the problems facing North Carolina ports, under tight deadlines and countless moving pieces. In a true sense, I am blessed to have a newsroom full of professionals who take great pride in their craft. Last year, we welcomed two individuals in the newsroom, Caleb Harshberger, who covers the residential and commercial real estate industry for us, and David Pertell, who manages our online news operation. Harshberger and Pertell have engaged with the community quickly, and from your continued interaction with them, it looks like the match worked. Most of our loyal subscribers know that in the past couple of years, TBJ has made a deliberate effort to move more stories behind the paywall. While some may object to this strategy, most of you understand and recognize that good content often is not free. Moreover, the trust between the reader and the author is far more important today than in any time in the past, especially in the age of the media being explosively slapped with credibility-draining fake news and biased taglines. Clearly, we are doing something right, but we will not stop here. As the Triangle grows, there will be new stories to cover, new people to follow, and new features to add. I am just thankful that you continue to give us the benefit of the doubt and are sticking with us as your financial media of record hits new milestones every year. And in news from around the state, Charlotte doesn't see rush to opportunity zones. This is written by Ashley Fahey. It has been more than 2 years since a lucrative tax break for real estate investment was introduced, but its effects have not yet rippled across the Charlotte market. Opportunity zones have been touted as a means of reinvigorating economically distressed communities. The federal legislation provides tax breaks on realized capital gains and investments made by funds in opportunity zones, and it was passed as part of the 2017 tax reform. While there have been several opportunity zone projects identified and funded in Charlotte, the program so far hasn't spurred a huge rush of investment that wouldn't have otherwise occurred. In fact, most opportunity zone projects in Charlotte are in areas such as NoDa that are attractive to developers regardless of the program. Land prices in the opportunity zones have been bid up to the point that the economics aren't much better than any other deals, says Dan Huffinus, managing partner at Catton Munchen Rosenman's Charlotte office. I think those deals can still make sense, but I don't know if it's sparked as much as we probably expected. The city's Economic Development Department created an online map to encourage funds to post their projects, but only two developments are mapped today, with one being the Envision Eastland project by the city. We're starting to see some activity where there's money sitting out there. People are talking about potential deals and projects, but there hasn't been that tipping point, says Todd DeLong, redevelopment manager with the city. Grub Properties is one Charlotte developer active in the Opportunity Zone space. The firm closed on its first Opportunity Zone fund at the end of 2019, which raised $142.4 million from more than 300 investors, says Clark Spencer, Senior Vice President of Investments at Grub Properties. The average investment was $400,000. That fund will be used to capitalize 7 Opportunity Zone projects, including 2 in Charlotte and 1 in Chapel Hill. Grub's fund uses a REIT structure, a commingled asset fund that reinvests any sale of Opportunity Zone properties back into an Opportunity Zone within the 10-year cycle. And finally, we have the Business Survey Pulse. What's your take on Truist logo branding? There were 110 responses, 43% meh, 22% hate it, 19% love it, 9% undecided, and 7% doesn't matter to me at all. And we're going to go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.